In his new book, How Children Succeed, Paul Tough argues that the conventional wisdom about success in children may be deeply flawed. He's drawn upon the work of several contemporary educators and researchers to make the case that prioritizing character development over cognitive ability is essential to improving teaching methods. Paul Tough has written extensively about education, and his previous book was Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Kander's Quest to Change Harlem in America. How Children Succeed is published by HMH Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Tough to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Good to be here. Your book is about changing how we think about what makes children successful. What kinds of skills do we normally associate with success in children?
Well, I think for a long time we've thought that the main thing that matters, and some of us think the only thing that matters, is cognitive skill, is IQ, the sort of things that get measured on standardized tests. But as I got further into the research in this book, I found that from a lot of different fields, from not just education but economics and neuroscience and psychology, there was this growing sense that we were looking at the wrong set of skills, that there's this other set, which economists call non-cognitive skills. Psychologists call them personality traits. The rest of us, I think, often think of them just as character, things like persistence and grit, self-control, optimism, that all of these things have a huge effect on how well children do.
When I went to school in a poor section of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, students were separated by IQ, with children with IQs of over 130 put into the IGC classes, the SPs, and then honor classes. As far as I can tell, very few of them have gone on to any major achievement. But I've always thought that was because they were from working and lower middle class backgrounds that would have had an impact on their aspirational levels. If you grow up thinking that a comfortable job working at the post office is enough, then you don't imagine going to Harvard and then later running for president.
I think there's a really interesting and complicated relationship between IQ, cognitive skill, these non-cognitive skills or character strengths, and class and economics. Part of why I'm so drawn to this research about non-cognitive skills is it really does seem like a way to help close the achievement gap and actually counter inequality. I spent a lot of my time reporting for this book on the south side of Chicago in really low-income neighborhoods, high-poverty schools. And the kids there have been doing badly for years, for generations. And when you look at their achievement test scores, their standardized test scores, they are consistently really poor. But what these kids have often in large amounts is character strengths like grit and self-control. They often need help with them, like all of us do. But some of the programs that I looked at, when they actually work on training kids in these non-cognitive skills, they have a huge effect on things, very important outcomes like who goes to college and who stays in college.
And isn't it true that if they develop these other skills, that their cognitive skill levels go up?
Yes, I think that is true as well. I mean, certainly having non-cognitive skills, especially for young kids, for kids in preschool and kindergarten, having those non-cognitive skills, things like being able to sit still and pay attention and focus and not get in fights with your friends, are enormously helpful in terms of learning. So if we can deal with those early on, especially in kids, it can be enormously helpful.
You begin your book by describing a program called Tools of the Mind that you encountered as a journalist. What did you see there?
So Tools of the Mind is a really interesting intervention. It's a pre-K and kindergarten program that's in thousands of classrooms around the country. And
is this part of Head Start?
No, it's not. It's a separate program. I don't think they're in any Head Start classrooms, but they're in. So when I went to Red Bank, New Jersey, and was in a public school there where they've got a pre-K program. And what Tools of the Mind emphasizes is self-regulation, self-control, self-discipline of all different kinds. And so they have this whole curriculum that lasts for 2 years that helps kids learn how to control themselves, how to regulate themselves. And at that age especially, I mean for all of us, but especially at that age at 4 and 5, it's incredibly important. One of the things that's so interesting about Tools of the Mind is that they don't their methods are not, it's not about like lecturing kids and telling them to sit still. They found that one of the most effective ways to help a child develop their self-regulation is through play, through mature dramatic play, they call it, those long, endless scenarios where you're the princess and I'm the doctor. And that process of focusing the mind on a story that way and knowing who plays what role is incredibly helpful for a child in developing self-regulation. And their thesis is that those skills, learning self-regulation skills in those first couple of years of school, are going to be enormously important going forward. And I think there's lots of evidence that that's going to be true.
So keeping the kids focused on something that is long-term rather than short-term is something that then helps them throughout the rest of their lives?
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
look, wouldn't have made me do my homework.
I think that there are these part of what's complicated, I think, about trying to teach non-cognitive skills is that there isn't sort of a clear curriculum that you can say, you know, work on your self-control, work on your grit. But there are lots of evidence out there that getting those skills early on helps out later on. Like, for instance, the famous marshmallow test that this psychologist Walter Mischel did, that when kids, 4-year-olds, were able to resist the temptation of a marshmallow to think, you know, into the future a little bit, at which point they would get 2 marshmallows instead of 1. It's that those kids who did really well in school later on. So if we can figure out ways to help those kids develop those skills early on, there's pretty clear evidence that it's going to help them down the road.
My guest is Paul Tough, whose previous book is Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem in America. Also, a series of acclaimed articles about character and childhood in the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker. He is also a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. And he has written a book called How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. It is published by HMH, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You discuss the work of James Heckman a lot. Who's he?
James Heckman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago who, after he won his Nobel back in 2000, used the sort of new influence that he had not to go deeper into economics, but to look around at the world more broadly. And what he was discovering right at about that same time was a lot about non-cognitive skills. Like most economists, he'd always thought that what mattered in terms of outcomes down the road was intelligence, was straight IQ. The experiment that made him really question that was this long study that he did about the GED. And he found that – so the GED, when it was invented, the idea was that if you're smart enough to get a GED, if you're smart enough to graduate from high school, you don't need to actually go to high school. You don't need to actually graduate. You can just get this piece of paper and you can do everything that a high school graduate can do. But when he looked at the data for what happened to these kids, he found that it was true that they were every bit as smart as the high school diploma holders, but it was not at all true that they were doing well in life. In fact, their trajectory through life looked exactly like high school dropouts. So that was a real challenge to this cognitive hypothesis, this idea that it was the cognitive skill that mattered. And what he concluded from that was that there were these other skills, these non-cognitive skills, that were exactly the skills that you need to graduate from high school, being able to sit still and hang in there and think about the future and regulate your impulses, that if you have those, you can get your high school diploma, and they're also going to set you in good stead for the rest of your life.
Well, so in the case of a GED, you're applying life skills, things that you've learned on your own. Has anybody done any study about how that affects what we've been seeing more and more now, where people aren't going into regular classrooms in colleges and universities, but taking courses on the internet, which they could do at any time of the day, and they could get up and walk around as much as they want, which you can't do in a class?
I think those new courses are really interesting, and I don't think that they've been studied well yet. I mean, so my concern about them, my theory about them is that they're going to be really useful to kids who have a lot of these non-cognitive skills, who are just able to direct their own learning and focus themselves. But when I, you know, have spent time in some of these low-income high schools, it's not exactly independent learning, but they do a lot of sort of computer-aided credit recovery classes where they're just sitting in a room and sort of clicking buttons to get to show that they've learned something. And I think for them, it's not working at all.
But then there are also the autodidacts, people who don't necessarily do well in school for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes they're bored, so who knows why, but they wind up teaching themselves.
Sure.
But they have these non-cognitive skills, even though a teacher
for sure
might not recognize that.
Absolutely. And I think that's a different issue, and I think it's a very genuine issue. Absolutely, there and those are kids who obviously are not only intelligent, but they've got a ton of what the psychologist Angela Duckworth calls grit. You know, that they have this perseverance and passion to learn something, and they're able to figure out how to teach themselves. And those kids, I think, are almost always going to do great. My worry is that a lot of the kids who do drop out and get a GED are not those kids.
Can you talk a bit more about Angela Duckworth's research?
Sure. So again, Angela Duckworth is a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and there are two sets of research that she's done that I think are really important. One is about self-control. That's where she started. And she discovered that self-control is something you can measure in quizzes and questionnaires and psychological tests. And that is enormously important in terms of a child's GPA in school. And in fact, it is more predictive if at the beginning of the year you give a kid an IQ test and a self-control test. The self-control test is more predictive of their GPA at the end of the school year than the IQ test. And so she studied self-control for a couple of years and then started to feel like, though it's important, it doesn't really get what she was trying to get at in terms of what skills help children succeed. And so she named this new skill called grit, which for her is – it involves self-discipline, but it's also about a passion for a goal. It's perseverance in sticking to – having a dream for your future and sticking to it. And so she invented this thing called the grit scale or the grit test. It's an 8-question test that people can take actually on her website at the University of Pennsylvania to see how gritty you are. And she found that people are actually pretty honest when they take this test about how much they persist with tasks, but that it is an incredibly predictive test, that it predicted in one experiment how likely kids at the University of Pennsylvania were to stay in school. She gave it to kids at the National Spelling Bee, and it predicted how well they would do, how many rounds they would last. And most amazingly, she gave it to cadets at West Point who were about to enter this incredibly rigorous summer training program called Beast Barracks, and it predicted which kids would be most likely to make it through that.
But couldn't we just look at the way people score on tests? I would assume that the kids who do best on when they take tests, midterms and finals and regents, whatever, are the ones who have this kind of grit, whereas even somebody else with a very high IQ who can't focus for whatever reason will do poorly. I don't know how predictive that is ultimately in life, but I would assume that for on the short term, the high test scores, which is something we're now arguing against in this country, would be good predictors.
Well, I think it really depends on the test. I mean, I should say as a caveat, you know, I'm not arguing that intelligence doesn't matter at all. It's hugely important. I'm just trying to argue that these other skills matter a whole lot as well. But I think to get back to that question of tests, one of the things that she, Angela Duckworth, and others have found that I find so interesting is that there's this divergence between how kids do on their GPA and how they do on tests that just strictly measure IQ. And a lot of standardized achievement tests are sort of a mix of both, but they tend towards measuring IQ. But what she and others have found is that in college especially, the kids who do best are the ones with the high GPAs, not the ones with the high SAT scores. GPA is more predictive of college persistence than IQ and SATs. And I think that's because what goes into GPA also involves a lot of these non-cognitive skills.
Another person you write about is Elizabeth Spiegel. What's she been doing?
So she is a chess teacher right here in New York City at IS 318 in Williamsburg, right on the border of Bedford-Stuyvesant. And she is a fantastic chess teacher. If you look at how well different who wins chess tournaments, it's usually the kids from the selective schools and the private schools and the rich suburban schools. And for the last few years, that has been thrown off completely by this one school, IS 318, which consistently wins 6th, 7th, and 8th grade tournaments all over the country. They even got on the front page of the New York Times not long ago for winning the high school tournament, even though they're not in high school.
Well, so they're good at chess. Does that suggest that they'll do well in other aspects of their lives?
It's a good question, and chess is a very specialized skill for sure. What was interesting to me about watching Elizabeth Spiegel teach is that while she was definitely teaching them chess knowledge, what I felt like she was teaching them much more was how to think, and, which is very much, I think, connected with these non-cognitive skills. She was able, you know, these are kids who are like a lot of them from low-income homes who in other schools are the kids who are acting up and getting in trouble. They aren't the smartest kids in the school even. But they have the ability to go to these chess tournaments and sit still for 4 hours at a time. And I think that's because of the way she teaches. She has this method after every game, whether it's at a tournament or just in the classroom, where kids come and they sit down and they go through their whole game move by move with her. And I think that process of going over your mistakes, seeing where you failed, figuring out what you could do differently next time is very character building.
Well, how do you take do these kids self-select, or does an antsy kid suddenly learn how to remain focused for 4 hours? How do you teach things like grit?
Well, I think teaching grit is very difficult. But to talk about how Elizabeth Spiegel does it, you know, she doesn't actually teach grit. She doesn't say, you know, you have to be gritty. She gets these kids incredibly engaged in chess. And she does that, I think, by giving them a way to think about their wins and their losses. She doesn't preach about chess a lot. She doesn't do what I think what some chess teachers do and try to convince kids that chess is interesting. Her theory is that chess is fun for all kids because you have this constant feedback. You're always measured about how well you're doing. You're learning constantly. You're constantly getting better. And so she thinks that the most useful thing that she can do is be really sort of hard on these kids, sort of tough with them. There are a lot of, teachers think that they're supposed to give 5 compliments for every 1 criticism. With Elizabeth, it's more like 5 criticisms for every 1 compliment. But the kids love it. And there's a way that they know that she is focused very, very intently on how well they're doing and where they're making mistakes and what they could do differently. And they know that they're learning from her.
My guest is Paul Tough, whose latest book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity and the Hidden Power of Character, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Tough, who has written a lot about education and is the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem in America, about a very successful educator. He also is a regular contributor to This American Life. Amy from Manhattan writes in, if someone didn't get the support to develop these qualities in childhood, is there anything they can do in adulthood to compensate?
And my answer would be yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you know,
some people are late bloomers.
Absolutely, in both cognitive and non-cognitive ways. I think we've learned that early interventions are incredibly effective. Not just those 4 and 5 year old interventions I was talking about, but interventions in the first year of life, interventions with parents can make a huge difference. But absolutely, I feel like people can change throughout their entire lives. So I spent time with high school students who were undergoing sometimes some tremendous transformations. But I think that's true into adulthood as well.
There are some people who believe that after you graduate from high school, it's a good idea to work at a job for a little while because you learn all sorts of skills that you wouldn't have learned that you don't learn just going through school. And if you may be very good passing tests and doing well in school, but you don't learn other skills that are really important for you.
For sure. And I would argue that, you know,
you dropped out of school, didn't you?
I did. I dropped out of college twice. So I would argue that a lot of the skills that those kids are learning aren't necessarily the skills they're learning at the job. It's more about character skills. And I think especially in high-achieving academic environments, so I spent a lot of time reporting at the Riverdale Country School, this elite private school in Riverdale. And this is something they were struggling with a lot there, that there were these kids who, you know, were on this very clear path through, you know, from preschool tutors all the way through private school into an Ivy League college. And that what I think the teachers and their parents were starting to feel was that these kids were incredibly good at taking tests, incredibly good at, like, hitting the next step on that sort of meritocratic pathway, but that they were often getting into real adult life and they were lost. You know, they hadn't had those sort of character-building experiences. And working can absolutely get you there. And some people would argue, you know, working on a farm or in a McDonald's or something like that might actually give you the skills you need more than working at, you know, Merrill Lynch.
Well, when I quit college because my parents needed me to go out to work, I went back later and after I'd worked at jobs. And I because I'd worked at Jobs, when a boss gave me an assignment, I started working on it right away. In my earlier school career, if a teacher gave me an assignment, I didn't even start thinking about it until the morning I had to hand it in. So I had actually learned all sorts of skills that made it a lot easier for me to get through school.
That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I would guess that some of what you learned as well was just like how to do things for yourself. And this idea, you know, I feel like there's something about the school system, especially I think for kids who do well, where, yeah, you never actually, like even though these kids are under huge stress and huge pressure, they never really have big challenges. It's always very clear what the next step is. And there's something about being on your own, whether you're, you know, working in your parents' store or doing anything else, that just suddenly you've got to answer these questions for yourself. You've got to develop your own character, figure out who you are. And I think there's lots of examples of kids who then go back to school and do much better as a result.
Another person you mentioned in your book is Nadine Burke Harris. What does she study?
So she is a pediatrician in San Francisco, working in this very low-income neighborhood called Bayview Hunters Point. And I went to talk to her because of her interest in this study about early childhood trauma and what kind of negative effects it had on kids going through their lives. This is sort of the, in some ways, the flip side of non-cognitive skills. This is how kids get problems with their non-cognitive abilities or their executive functions, as neuroscientists call them, early in life. And what she found was that the kids in her practice were, they had some health problems that she could treat, but the big problems in their lives were all about the environment around them. They were surrounded by chaos and violence and real difficulties that were having a huge effect on their abilities, not just on their physical health, but on their mental health, on their ability to persist in school. And so as she got deeper and deeper into this research around stress and biology and its effect on brain development, she came to believe that that was really at the root of problems that her kids were facing in her practice. And so she, over the last couple of years, she's been working to develop methods to counter that, to help kids do better.
Another listener writes in, Aurea from Manhattan. Can you specify ways that people can develop grit?
So, not very easily. No. I mean, I do think that there are methods that certain teachers are using to teach grit, but the problem is there's not a clear curriculum. There's not a book you can read to give to your kid to teach them grit. Where I think grit is developed is through failure, is through learning to overcome setbacks. Well, and so I think the biggest help that parents and teachers can give kids is giving them the wherewithal to manage adversity, to deal with failure.
I would think this is one of the most difficult areas, quantifying. One of the biggest problems with prioritizing non-cognitive skills would, I imagine, be quantifying them. Can educators rate character? How can we even know what character traits are the important ones?
Well, some educators in New York City are trying. So I wrote in the Times Magazine a year ago and then expanded that reporting in this book about this experiment that two schools here in New York are doing, the Riverdale Country School, this private school, and the Kipp Infinity Charter School in West Harlem. And they have developed something that at Kipp is called the Character Report Card, where kids are actually evaluated on 7 different character strengths. And they're still working out, and I'm not sure that report card is exactly the right phrase, because it's not really like an academic report card. You don't get held back for not having enough zest or curiosity. But what I think they've developed is this document that allows teachers and parents and children together to talk about the children's character strengths. And so I went to report card night at Kipp Infinity, the first night that they were introducing the character report card. And the conversations that parents and teachers and kids were having were really positive, were really powerful.
But these are abstract traits, aren't they? It's hard to give a kid an A in grit, isn't it?
It's hard, but I don't think...
And people disagree on what the important ones are, the researchers you discussed.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that it would probably be a mistake to turn this into a true report card that was going to affect how kids did in life. But I think what it really is at Kipp is this sort of character conversation piece that lets these conversations happen that are incredibly valuable.
A listener asks, didn't Maria Montessori emphasize some of these values like grit?
Yes, absolutely. So when the article came out in the Times Magazine last year, I heard a lot from Montessori parents and Montessori graduates who said that this is exactly what Montessori schools are doing. I think there's a lot of parallels.
And since Montessori schools have been recognized as successful over the years, why haven't we seen more of that integrated into the public school system?
It's a good question. I don't know enough about Montessori schools to talk about that. But I think I don't know. I think it's one way to do it for sure. But I don't think that it's about having. I don't think the only way to teach these skills is to have that one very specific method.
We have heard a lot of debate today about education reform. How does your understanding of the factors that lead to success inform your understanding of those conversations?
I guess in a couple of ways. I mean, one, I feel like part of my frustration with the education debate is that it is really narrowly focused on what can be measured on these cognitive tests, on standardized tests. And you know, the Obama administration in lots of ways is doubling down on the reforms of No Child Left Behind and putting increasing emphasis on those test scores. And what, you know, these scientists are discovering is that those test scores don't measure a lot of really important stuff. And what that says to teachers is don't pay attention to these non-cognitive skills because they don't get measured on the tests that are going to, you know, affect your hiring and firing and tenure. Instead, just focus on what can be measured on those tests. And that's a mistake, I think.
And you say at the end of the book that the government can save money by shifting its priorities, eliminating all of those tests and their cost?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I definitely wouldn't go that far. But I think that there are other priorities that we should be emphasizing in the education system. What I'm talking about there at the end of the book is specifically about low-income neighborhoods, where again, a lot of my reporting was in Chicago in some of these deep poverty neighborhoods. And in those places, we're spending a ton of money on kids, but we're spending it in this really haphazard way. And what all of these researchers, I think, are finding is that if we were able to coordinate that money more effectively, create a system that was going to help kids, you know, from doing what Nadine Burke-Harris is doing with young kids in pediatric clinics through doing what a lot of these interventions are doing in school, we could create a system that would not only save us money but would also lead to much more positive outcomes for lots of these kids.
You write that the United States is a world leader in college dropouts. Has that always been the case?
It has not always been the case, no. The when I went and looked at the data on college persistence, I was really struck by it, really surprised by it. So one thing I think is fairly well known is that we've fallen just since the mid-1990s from being the world leader in college graduation rate to I think we're 12th right now, which is a big fall for only 15, 17 years. But what I didn't know is that at the same time, the numbers that have been going up are our college dropout rates.
But it also could be because colleges are so expensive and some people just can't afford to stay.
That definitely could be part of it, but the people who've studied it suggest that a lot of it, a lot of why kids are dropping out has to do with their non-cognitive skills.
How much of your interest in this topic comes from your own experiences as a college dropout, as a parent?
A lot. I mean, I think probably it's being a parent that was the biggest motivation for me. So my wife and I had our first child just as I was starting this research 3 years ago. And I think it was an enormously motivating force.
Are you going to send your kid to a private school?
No, I don't think I am, not least because I can't afford it. But I think that it's already, you know, he's only three, so we're not doing a lot of school decisions
yet.
Yeah,
but now this is the time when a lot of parents are already jockeying for a pre-K slot, aren't they?
It's true. But I think, I think we're going to try and steer clear of that world. But I think, you know, the way that it's really affected me already is not necessarily in terms of his relationship to the education system. It's just the skills that, you know, we're teaching him as he's growing up. And I think that there's lots of evidence that, especially in those first couple of years of life, there's an enormous amount that kids can do just in terms of how they play and interact and help their kids that can set them on the right course for the rest of their lives.
Who do you think are the most problematic people in terms of shifting the dialogue where it needs to be? Is it the College Board? Is it Congress? Is it the people at Mensa who have a vested interest in believing IQ is the most important thing?
I mean, I don't like to think of it in terms of opponents to this way of thinking. I think we're, a lot of us are kind of stuck in a system that prioritizes certain things. And so I do think college is a good place to start. And I think there is this kind of standoff where, you know, colleges measure, they have to run their admissions based on college board scores, which means that schools, high schools have to teach to those tests, which means that parents have to freak out about those tests and be really anxious about them. And so I think that, that the process of changing that, I think there are some people in college admissions, for instance, at different colleges, who are trying to think differently and are saying, like, what, you know, we don't actually think that these SAT scores that we've put so much emphasis on are the are going to best predict who's going to persist in college. So how could we do things differently?
So who would you like to read this book? Educators, parents, politicians?
All of the above.
No, I understand. You want everybody to buy the book. But I mean, in the end, who are the most important in changing the way things now are done?
It's a really good question, but I'm going to stick with my answer because I really do feel like it's not enough for any one of those three groups to change. I really think that for the big kind of change that I think is necessary to happen, it has to be parents and teachers and other educators and politicians as well, that all of them right now are contributing to the system we have, and all of them can contribute to reforming it.
Lots of liberals are uncomfortable with the idea that improving character is in underprivileged students is somehow the solution. How would you respond to them?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that there are some people who are especially anxious about the idea of you know, going into low income neighborhoods and trying to improve character. My sense of when I go into those neighborhoods as a reporter is that this is a conversation that's already happening there. Whether you call it character or behavior or non-cognitive skills or anything else, that the parents and the kids in those neighborhoods know that this is a real problem, that this is what is holding a lot of kids back. And so I think they're ready to talk about character in a different way.
Paul Tough will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. Joined by special guest Ira Glass, will he be interviewing you?
He will, yeah.
And the book that they will be discussing, the one we've just been talking about, is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And have you been getting much feedback so far?
Yeah, the book is just out today, so it's early yet. But yeah, no, I've been hearing
I think
really...
a lot of people are going to be excited, and others are going to be rather angered by it.
I think that's probably true. I hope more excited.